On this week's 51%, a filmmaker spotlights senior women.
We don't see enough movies that are made about women full stop, let alone about older women. And very few of them ever just focus on the pursuit of female friendship.
The play's the thing to highlight health disparities in African American women, and a punk musician puts women and inclusivity at the forefront. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Sharon Upberg returns with her 51% segment Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Zara Hayes, a British filmmaker who has directed films for Netflix, the BBC, A&E, National Geographic, and more. She's probably best known for her feature documentary, The Battle of the Sexes, the story of Billie Jean King's historic tennis victory against Bobby Riggs. Now she's directed and co-written her first narrative feature, Palms, starring Diane Keaton. Inspired by true events, Palms is a female-powered film, which follows a group of senior women who form their own cheerleading squad in a retirement community. Hayes responds to why the subject of Palms was of interest to her.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that this is a real phenomenon, and I came across it when I was thinking about making a documentary about cheerleading, and I came across the fact that across America there are groups of women who have taken to picking up pom-poms and setting up cheerleading teams in later life. And something about that notion just really struck me and really kind of appealed to something within my storytelling instincts, because I've always had an interesting relationship with cheerleading, because I'm not from America. I grew up in Britain where we didn't have cheerleading, and so my knowledge of cheerleading came through American movies and TV, and it was kind of this exotic thing. And I was very passionate about dance when I was younger, and so I was interested in it as a sport. But then as I got kind of older and my kind of, I guess my feminist consciousness was raised slightly, I kind of started to have mixed feelings about it, because on the one hand, it's this brilliant sport that and group activity that women kind of do together and engage in, and it's very empowering in that sense. But on the other hand, it's still, the symbolism of it is still that women are cheering on the sidelines for men who are the main event. So I had this kind of mixed, difficult relationship with cheerleading. And then when I saw these women who were doing it later in life and who had reclaimed that, all of that archetype and stereotype, and were just doing it on their own terms and not asking for anyone's permission, but just pursuing it for the joy of dancing and kind of being cheerleaders, I thought that was really exciting and had something to say more broadly about women. So that's kind of why it appealed, really.
It is so amazing that this is a true story. It's so fascinating to me and so empowering of women at this age. So what's the fundamental issue in this film?
Well, for me, the cheerleading is kind of the lens through which we get to tell a story about female friendships and the power of female friendship, and to celebrate that, especially later in life, because we don't see enough movies that are made about women full stop, let alone about older women, and very few of them ever just focus on the pursuit of female friendship without being sort of mired in other storylines about romance, or, you know, what it's like to be someone's mother or grandmother or wife. And I felt like what was really exciting about this concept was that it was about a group of disparate women coming together whose lives might not have crossed paths before, or had it not been for cheerleading, and that they came together to do this thing that they've all wanted to do and for whatever reason haven't managed to do it in their lives. And they missed out on their opportunity when they were younger, and they came together. And for me, that's the fundamental message that I wanted to put across on screen, because I think that we don't see enough stories being told about women's relationships. And I think there's a whole wealth of humor and heart and kind of support and empathy that we can find out there if we look for it. And that's what I saw in these groups of women who were really doing it.
I'm wondering why, as a documentary filmmaker, you chose to do this as a feature film versus a documentary.
Well, once I figured out that this was a much bigger deal than just one team, that this was actually something of a phenomenon, there were a number of teams across America, and actually there are different ones around the world. There's even a Japanese senior cheerleading team, believe it or not. And I felt like in the conversations I was having, if I could take the elements from all of these stories and kind of create one coherent story that would fit together, I felt like it could give it could bring out all the different elements that I was interested in and the observations of the things that I'd seen in talking to these real women, but also kind of elevate the material to a scope that I thought it deserved and a scale. Because that, you know, there's no denying that the power of the movie and the, in terms of, you know, creating iconic images, and I felt like I wanted to see women, older women, you know, being cheerleaders later in life on a big screen in a darkened room, in a darkened theater, and I felt like I wanted to give it that treatment, and it just lent itself to cinema for me. So that's why I kind of went down the road of thinking of it as a narrative. But I wanted to bring the heart of the documentary sort of insights to it, if I could.
It is such a coup to have someone like Diane Keaton playing a lead role in the film, and will encourage so many people to come out and see the film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she holds such a status and such a special place in people's hearts all around the world, especially here. And I think that in casting her as Martha, I think that she embodies some of that idiosyncratic rebellious spirit that I saw in the real women, and I felt like she was perfect for it. And you know, she really sort of brings so much to that role in terms of her own attitude and the fact that she is unrelentingly her own woman. She isn't kind of managed by legions of people trying to kind of airbrush her image by any means. She's very real, and that's something that massively appealed to me.
I am so impressed with you as one of only 5 women with studio movies out this year, but I know it's also a big responsibility. What's next on your radar? What's your next passion project coming up? Do you have a new mission in your future?
Yeah, I mean, I really want to keep telling stories about powerful women doing things that surprise and shock people and potentially rub people up the wrong way, because I think that, you know, we're still in a place where it's 51% of the population and a tiny percentage of the stories that get airtime. So I think that there are just so many brilliant stories out there to be told. And in terms of my next project, I'm kind of looking for something that resonates as strongly with me as the idea of Poms did. And I'm still kind of casting the net to find that. There is one idea I'm pursuing that's about an untold piece of history in which women are kind of front and center of it, and I'm trying to kind of lock that one down. But if that project doesn't happen, it will be something along those lines that contains some of the elements that I'm interested in using my voice to put out there, because I think that you know, we need more of these stories. We need more people willing to tell stories for older audiences as well, and I think that's something that's really come out with Poms. Is like, we've made it for people who are the people who go to the movies who are kind of 50 and above. And again, I think that is also kind of in its own way revolutionary, or at least unusual, because we're so youth-obsessed in culture that we sort of leave these people out of the equation often. And so all of these things coalesce around themes that I'm interested in, and I'm just waiting for the right kind of alignment of stars to sort of jump onto the next project.
Sounds like you're looking for something with another powerful message, which is still so important, as there are so many women's stories that have yet to be told. So for women in coming up in your industry, what's your best piece of advice for her? For someone who, say, wants to be the next Zara Hayes?
Don't do it. No, I'm joking. I'd say in all seriousness, try not to be disheartened by the abysmal numbers. Because if you start to read about and internalize the statistics, I don't think it helps anybody, because they are very depressing and they don't seem to be changing at a quick enough rate. But I think the only way to change the game is to be in it. And to your point earlier about, you know, what types of stories. I think to not be afraid of telling bigger stories and to not kind of limit what an idea should be. You know, this idea, I could have made it, I could have settled for it at a kind of smaller budget or at a smaller level, and I pushed it to be some as big as it could be. And I'll do that with everything. You know, every idea that I have, I'll question, you know, am I thinking big enough? Am I being ambitious enough with it? Because I think that that's something that women who are in the industry have to do. But I would say, you know, on a day-to-day level, you have to really love the thought of making, the process of making a film and the thought of being able to put your stories out there, because you kind of, like I say to people, it's a bit like running a marathon. You've got to kind of outrun everybody around you and keep going and just have the stamina and not be downbeaten by all the things that's standing your way, because they are very real. You know, it would be disingenuous to not be aware of them. But I think if you can kind of somehow be aware but not internalize and just charge forward and hope that the stories that you do get the chance to bring resonate with audiences, and then that will hopefully, you know, when the money comes, people stop asking as many questions and go with it. So that's my advice.
That's good advice. Zara, thanks so much for being with us today. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. African-American women in Indiana face disparities in health care and health outcomes. They are more likely than white women to die during or after childbirth, and they have higher rates of breast cancer deaths and diabetes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on a research project that uses theater to shine a spotlight on some of the possible reasons why this is the case.
The play is called One Blood.
I was in a lot of pain.
It weaves together the interviews of 10 African-American women in central Indiana.
But she gets very frustrated.
Their words describe the ways they have encountered disparity in the healthcare system. As a provider.
I had a manager tell me flat out to my face, do not go take care of this patient. She does not like blacks.
As a patient, not being given equal care.
For some reason, the doctor thinks, well, maybe our education is less than theirs, or maybe, you know, like we're not intelligent enough to have a conversation with them on their level.
The production at the Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis is the brainchild of Sally Wasmith, assistant professor at Indiana University's Department of Occupational Therapy. Wasmith says she was spurred by recent reports of disparity in African-American women's health outcomes. She says the women she interviewed opened up.
More than one of them said that the heart is impacted by the daily stress of being discriminated against. And there are higher rates of cardiac disease and poorer health outcomes for black women.
She says she wants the play to leave an impression.
To make sure that this message is heard by healthcare professionals so that they can look at their own implicit biases and how that might impact their care.
Sherry Harris was one of the women interviewed for the piece. She had gone to the doctor because she was having spasms. He didn't know what was wrong and didn't suggest testing. In the play, the actress depicts Harris's story.
Am I not good enough for a test? So he's like, well, I didn't think you'd want to have all that done.
In real life, Harris lives on the northeast side of Indianapolis. She's a recruiter with an engineering degree from Purdue. She was taken aback when her doctor prescribed medicine without giving her a diagnosis.
What's wrong with me? And you expect for me to take this medicine, I'm not going to take it.
Harris says after that experience, she wrote him a letter. She told him what he should have known.
Science is something that you have to rule out certain things to figure out what's what. We've not done that here in this doctor's office today.
The doctor responded and asked her back for a full examination. The play includes numerous stories of how women have been mistreated by healthcare professionals. With professionals and providers in the audience, the performance doubles as research. Assistant Professor Dr. Sally Wasmith says the play fits the bill for what's called narrative medicine.
This practice of narrative medicine and close reading actually improves health outcomes. It improves communication between providers. It reduces medical errors.
She says healthcare providers have reported better understanding of their patients.
What we really need as healthcare professionals is more nuanced and detailed information about your particular story and how your disease or how your illness is impacting you in the context of your individual life.
Wasmuth has used theater as occupational therapy in past studies, and she says her results show it can be therapeutic. Interview participants from this play have expressed that it was. Some have also found it upsetting, including Sherry Harris. She attended the first showing.
I thought I was going to be okay, but I think my stomach started hurting a little bit during the play.
She decided not to go to the final performance, but sent a message that was shared with the audience after the show.
It's important for those who are not African American to help us. If they see something, to step in, because it appears as though we're invisible and we're disrespected.
Because as the last line of the play, One Blood, says,
we're all humans and we all bleed the same color blood.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Punk musician and creator of Community Record Store, Kana Harris, is part of the Austin, Texas music scene. She wants to make sure women on the music scene aren't overlooked.
Growing up in an extremely liberal household where, like, I remember participating in a lot of protests during the Bush administration, and I would, like, come home from school, and my dad would be like, did you do the walkout today? And I'd be like, hell yeah, I did. He'd be like, good, I'm proud of you for exercising your right to protest. So, like, the idea of speaking out against sexism in my family was just like, of course you did. Like, any good person would.
Kana Harris is a fixture in Austin's punk scene and a slinger of vinyl. She plays in the band Zetas and now owns Bluebonnet Records in Lockhart. Going into this project blindly, we were expecting to meet a punk rock chick. Kana Harris is more. She's loving, goofy, and involved in creating community as a record store owner.
Yeah, I could just, you know, maybe start a label or something, but what if I become a store and I just start actively, aggressively ordering women artists and selling them? What happens if you actually put DIY promotion that the labels can't afford, but on a store level, and using your store as a community space, then you're exposing all these people from your community to these other artists that are not on the radio, you know, maybe not even on their radar. But they're going to buy it just because, like, they're like, oh, Kana and Cody, we want to support their store. And we heard this playing in their store on First Friday when we brought the kids and we liked it, so we bought it. And it's like, it's literally that easy.
Kana took her years as a musician and experiences working in Austin record shops to create her store on her own terms.
And a lot of people that are in charge are wrong. So if someone tells you that you can't do it or that it's not the way to do it, like, don't, just ignore them. Period. I'm trying to go into it with this template of, like, I'm not going to tolerate, you know, X, Y, and Z type of comments, because that's not part of, like, actually being a fan of music. That's part of keeping women out of music. So we're not going to do that.
Kana was tired of the music snob, rocker dude mentality. You know the type. Jack Black is Barry in High Fidelity.
Can I have it then?
No, you can't.
Why not?
Well, it's sentimental, tacky crap. That's why not. Do we look like the kind of store that sells I just called to say I love you? Go to the mall.
This isn't just for, like, rocker dudes or, like, punishers. This is also for, like, young girls and women and trans people and whoever basically likes music. Like, it really shouldn't be for anybody. Like, excluding anybody, I should say.
Through her business savvy and DIY punk ethos, she is building a space that is inviting for everyone.
My goal is to become a seller that can really promote those artists. So then it's like, well, why is this store able to sell all these queer and trans and women artists, and all these stores are still ordering the same old, you know? And so I think it would be interesting to cause that disruption. I don't really have a goal other than that. Like, let's see if I can piss somebody off. Like, not, and it's not that basic. Like, I'm not really that aggressive of a person, but it's like, the point of the store is to be a place for the community.
Kana is changing the record, and with Blue Bonnet, she's creating the inclusive community she is always looking for.
Well, this is why the record store is important, because it's a community space. It's also a space for me to express myself as an owner and say, here's what I like to listen to. That's how it works. That's the one thing that's hard to handle sometimes with, like, being a punk that wants, like, a beautiful utopian future of community, but then also, like, I work in retail, which fundamentally is capitalism. I struggle with that. I mean, I'm not gonna lie, but if I'm gonna be in retail, music is probably the thing I can sleep best at night doing. Like, even if I'm, like, conniving, it's like, I'm conniving to sell Harry Nilsson records. Like, okay, that's fine. I can live with that. I don't think I'm gonna, like, go to soul purgatory for that or anything, you know what I mean?
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words saying.
This story was produced by Mary Holliman, Tony Plata, and Cynthia Luna, with assistance from Michelle Mejia, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
And now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns weighs in on compliments with unintended consequences.
When I put together an offbeat outfit and someone says they like it, I'm happy. You see, fashion's not my jam. So when I manage a stylish outfit that draws compliments, it feels like a big deal. Likewise, if people congratulate me on a good story or tell me they like one of my radio essays, that makes my day. I guess you could say that I don't exactly mind compliments. Maybe you enjoy a good compliment too. It makes sense, right? Praise makes us feel good. But compliments can also do the absolute opposite. Recently, someone said to me, "Wow, you look really good today." Well, wow, do I usually look like a dustbin? Another time, a different someone said, "Jerry, you are looking so youthful." So does that mean I typically look three steps from the grave? Statements like those, while kindly meant, are unintentionally laced with subtext. Think about it. By saying that someone looks particularly good one day can imply that on other days they look meh at best. I need to tell you a story about a friend of mine, let's call her Sarah, who has been suffering from an avalanche of compliments. Yes, I did say suffering. One after another, people have praised her for losing weight. "Oh, you look so good. You look great. Looking healthy. Sarah, you look beautiful." Now, all of Sarah's friends love her. They are well-intentioned and genuine in their positive reaction to her new physical state. But Sarah's not feeling the love. Sarah's weight loss wasn't because of a New Year's resolution. She didn't drop pounds because she started prepping for a lifelong goal of running a marathon or because she's on the latest nutritional health food fad. Losing weight was not a conscious choice. It happened because of a debilitating chronic autoimmune disease. For a while there, Sarah's medicines were working to help keep her illness mostly in check. But in the last year, her medication stopped doing the job. This happens with chronic illness sometimes. Just when you think everything's under control, something implodes and you're back to square one. And that's what happened to Sarah. Without effective medication, she's increased her already righteous dietary interventions to help manage her disease. Sarah works very hard to keep food in her body and keep her weight, strength, and spirits up. So every well-intentioned compliment she receives about her weight reminds her how sick she often feels. In short, every effort that people kindly make to raise her up pulls her down. And there's another side to this, too. By focusing on how good Sarah looks and how healthy she appears, which is hugely ironic in her situation, it implies that for the last umpteen years she's been looking bad. That she hasn't been exactly pleasing to behold. In short, you could say that every compliment about her weight loss today fat shames her recent past. She puts it like this: "When I hear you look great, what I really hear is, you used to be fat, but now that you're thin, you look great. So now I'm chronically ill and insulted." No one means to do this to her. Human beings aren't usually out to hurt people whenever we give compliments. But still, her story makes me think. You see, being thin doesn't necessarily equate with health. body types are all different. And while the body positivity movement is really helping to alter the cultural narrative about body size, we still live in and were raised in a thin, crazed culture. So we often associate thinness with health. America idolizes the very thin in popular culture and advertising. Society also teaches us to disdain those who aren't very thin. And because obesity causes health problems, we persistently hear how important it is to keep our weight down or to drop those pesky pounds. So the story we hear and tell ourselves over and over is that getting thinner is a good thing. I just think that maybe we need to stop acting like Pavlov's dogs whenever we see someone who lost weight and, bing, automatically throw out the compliments. Do we really need to endorse society's bias for thinness and hand out skinny compliments like Halloween candy? Not only might we fat-shame someone we care about, but we could cause additional pain when tender stories simmer beneath the surface, such as a physical or emotional illness that is causing weight loss. By focusing so much on what is on the outside, we can hurt what is on the inside, like what happened to Sarah. I don't mean to say that compliments are never okay. I'm not here to tell you to ignore friends who you know are trying to lose weight. I just want to share what I learned, that it's important to remember that everyone's weight loss story is different. Sarah's situation taught me to be more mindful about the compliments I give and the assumptions embedded within them. I don't want my words to make someone's day horrible. I want them to make someone's day.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1566.